Festivities for America's 250th anniversary have already kicked off. But what is the secret to America's success? Why has the nation become great? And what about the rest of us non-Americans? Is there more to this anniversary than, say, insufferable American flag waving? Well, let's find out as we look at the latest Trumpet Print magazine on today's Trumpet World. Welcome back to Trumpet World. How America Became Great. That's the cover of our latest July edition of our Trumpet Print magazine. It is a celebratory issue in many ways, but it also contains a powerful warning and even rebuke. And I want to make clear from the outset, this magazine, even this episode, will focus rightly, I think, on this anniversary, on a lot of the positives of the United States and of America. But this is also much more than simply rah, rah, America is awesome flag waving. There are many vital messages for non-Americans in this magazine. I mean, this is Trumpet World. We've got a worldwide audience in mind. And really, the focus isn't on America. The question of why America became great points you directly to God. So to talk about that, I'm joined by Trumpet Assistant Managing Editor Philip Nice. Philip, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Assistant Managing Editor and insufferable flag waver. I have a flag waving on my front porch right now.
I am kind of excited about this format. I do like the fact that we have an American and a non-American, and I think hopefully we can make a show that both audiences can, non-Americans and Americans, can enjoy, and which in this divided kind of atmosphere, I think is a bit of a challenge, actually, but enjoy and learn from. But I mean, maybe you could start with some of your perspective on this this 250th anniversary issue.
I have been really really excited about the 250th anniversary for a reason. I think that is different than many Americans. We did back on Trumpet Hour. I did a show one time about the bicentennial and the phenomenon that it was in America, but people in Japan were getting up early to watch some of the festivity. Like it was not, I won't say it was global, but it was kind of international, this bicentennial of this unique nation. I mean, this is an unusual thing. This nation that has existed for almost 250 years, much as the British Empire was very different than other empires and powers that had came before it. But I tell you, I have been watching the big steam locomotive making its way from California to Philadelphia and back again, and the block parties and the fireworks shows and the baseball and the all the Americana that a lot of people find irritating. But as the World Cup kind of shows, a lot of Europeans are kind of enjoying it too. So let me just say that there are things to enjoy in this country, and that's not just, you know, big soda pops at the gas station. There's a lot of goodwill happening right now, even from the, you know, our Scottish visitors, our Japanese visitors, and so forth. So it is a time of pride, but like celebration and positivity that we have sorely lacked in the Obama years, and really even before that, since September, even before September 11th, actually. So this is fun in a way, but it's also deceptive. There's also a danger in that.
Yeah, I have enjoyed that about the World Cup. Just the you know, so much of World Cup rivalry and just rivalry in general is about putting others down to put yourself up. And maybe it's just the zeitgeist. Like, there are just a few accounts that have gone viral for just unashamedly celebrating things about the United States. And not necessarily putting their own country down or any others, but just going and enjoying their time in America. So I think that's a great spirit to go into this 250th anniversary year. But the first article from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry kicks off the whole magazine with that cover, or with a similar question to what's on the front cover, the title being How America Became Great. And looking at, you know, this is one of the big questions in history, really. It puts a specific country on it, but what makes a nation great? If you want your country to be great, what does it need to do? And what's interesting is Mr. Flurry begins by kind of exposing that actually America's recent leaders haven't known the answer. And he begins by talking about George W. Bush, where he was asked this question and didn't really have a great answer to it. What I also think is interesting is he points out that some of the great leaders of the past did have a much better vision and a much better understanding of how America became great. And so it sets up the whole issue with this discussion. What is the secret to national success?
Mm-hmm. My wife sent me this page with this part over here highlighted. Yeah, this part over here highlighted. And she was saying, we could read this every single day. And Mr. Flurry gets right to it. I mean, you're on page one, and you immediately read, many Americans today feel guilty because we have these advantages. This nation, you know, like you're saying, a lot, and we're both have noticed, a lot of people are saying, what a rich country this is, right? What a wealthy country it is. What, you know, advantages this country has, as well as the freedoms which make possible the wealth. But he says, many Americans feel guilty because we have those advantages. We should not feel guilty about that. We ought to feel guilty because we don't know why we have those advantages and because we don't use them the way they should be used. That phrase is kind of like the whole issue right there. It kind of encapsulates this whole Trumpet issue. And then the part that my wife had highlighted was President Lincoln. You know, like you said, we have not a prophet, but a president of the United States who basically spoke like a 19th century prophet, just telling us in plain American terms what the reality is. And so this is his, you know, proclamation, President Abraham Lincoln. And he says, whereas it is the duty of nations as well as of men to own their dependence upon the overruling power of God, to confess their sins and transgressions in humble sorrow, yet with assured hope that genuine repentance will lead to mercy and pardon, and to recognize the sublime truth announced in the Holy Scripture and proven by all history, that those nations only are blessed whose God is the Lord. And the proclamation goes on from there. But this is not religiosity. This is not, you know, American Protestantism, you know, per se. This is statements of historical fact being made by a president who is objectively great and objectively did great things for this country because of this attitude, because of this, not in spite of this. This wasn't like window dressing on his campaign or his presidency, but it was the core of President Lincoln's message. And Mr. Flurry has emphasized this over and over and over, and like, told me, and I think you could read that every day, and Americans should read that every day, because there's something far greater to the existence of America, its power, its freedom, its wealth, there will be a problem. There will be guilt. There will be a hole in your purpose and mind if you're an American, if you don't understand this, if you don't get back to at least what President Lincoln was saying, and then to the Bible history and the revelation that shows why America is an entity. Like, why are we a nation at all? You know, why are these people a nation? There's a serious problem, and I think we've seen that if we don't understand the how America became great, like Mr. Fleury says in this opening article.
And what he really does here is, you know, present that vital lesson from history, but then answer the question that Lincoln couldn't answer. You know, Lincoln said, "We have been the recipients of the choicest bounties of heaven." He didn't really know why. You know, I think America's founding fathers actually did have some excellent insight onto the answer to that question. You know, they talked about being an example to the world, and you know, there is a lot of truth there, but that is not the complete answer to the question. And Mr. Fleury goes back to really the truth that is in Herbert W. Armstrong's pioneering book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, something you can prove from the Bible, that the United States and Britain and some other countries are descended from the biblical nations of Israel. And they were promised all of these national blessings. And understanding this suddenly answers all of so many apparent contradictions in the Bible. You know, like, you know, God promises blessings to the descendants of Jacob on a scale vastly bigger than anything given to just the Jews. And then you understand, well, the Jews are just one tribe. Well, that helps start to answer that question. Also, God says to Abraham, you know, I will do this. I will definitely do this. There's no ifs, there's no conditions. I am going to give you these promises. And then when Israel comes out of Egypt, God says, well, if you do this and if you do this, if you keep my Sabbaths and if you don't worship idols and here are some conditions, then I will do that. Like, well, why conditions to one, not conditions to another? Is that a contradiction? Well, no. They were certain to Abraham, sure to happen. But exactly when? Well, that depended on Israel and how they behaved and what they did. And when they failed to meet those conditions, the blessings weren't canceled, like some teach. They weren't annulled. That promise to Abraham, God couldn't go back on that. They were delayed and given in these later days. And so Mr. Armstrong goes into that. And really this establishes the pattern for the whole rest of the magazine. And I really like the way this whole magazine fits together into a fantastic unified whole. Because if you look at why America is great, the material blessings, you know, all of those things that Abraham Lincoln listed, and the climate and the blessings of geography, absolutely essential. And as Lincoln pointed out, that's not something that reflects on American ingenuity or anything that America has done. Those are blessings they were given from God. Then, though, you also have to look at, well, there are principles in the U.S. Constitution, and there are laws of cause and effect, and there are ultimately truths that are grounded in the Bible that Americans understood that were also essential to having success. And to get that full picture, you need both sides. And I like the fact that then the rest of the magazine, different articles delve in depth in different parts of that picture.
Right, right. Yeah, this really sets it out. Like you said, it asks the question and it answers it. And it just encapsulates the issue. But the conclusion to this, I think, is powerful. When someone asks us to explain America's national greatness, we should know clearly without qualification that our national greatness can be explained with one word, God. There are Americans out there who would answer in that way, but they have no idea. They have no idea that it's traceable, it's specific, it's in the Bible. There's specific things that are identified. What are the odds that North America is just waiting for, you know, that it's formed the way it is, it has the climate the way it does, it has the harbors that it does, it has the river systems that it does. These are all things that are way beyond human beings, and that population came when it did, it expanded how it did. It had relations with these other countries in the way that it did. This is not an America thing. This is a humanity thing. Like in the history of humanity, you know, you're gonna want to know, like, wow, man, how did the Chinese get to be, you know, a great people? How did the British Empire do what it did? All very suddenly, and I could go on and on about that. But how did America come to be? Like that's a humanity question. And the promises to Abraham that Mr. Flory emphasizes, and that United States and Britain and prophecy by Mr. Armstrong emphasize, is that those promises to Abraham were civilizational scale promises. They were national scale promises. They were change the course of human history scale promises. And this issue just kind of takes those things one at a time, and really gives you what I think. No, I know nobody else can give you. United States and Britain prophecy can give you this, and even better than this issue. But are you a church-going American Christian? Has anyone ever tried to explain why America is great from the Bible? Because it doesn't track our righteousness. Abraham Lincoln was telling us we were severely unrighteous in 1863, and our founders in 1776 said much the same thing. This is happening in spite of Americans, right? This is something that's far bigger than Americans, and it's a lesson to humanity. And only this creator God could do what has been done in this country. So any exaltation or sense of pride that lacks God, that doesn't just talk about God over and over, is severely and dangerously lacking.
I think that leads nicely to our next article, Mapping a Superpower. I think, you start saying, well, America's been blessed geographically. And yeah, that's pretty uncontroversial. A lot of people would say, well, yeah, America's got some pretty good geography. But what this article does is just start to get specific on how blessed. And it's kind of insane. Like you start breaking down, the world's largest contiguous piece of farmland, overlaid by the largest navigable water system in the world, so that you can grow tons of food and then transport it easily. Like a wonderful benefit that no one else has. You go over and you've got massive pieces of farmland in Ukraine and no easy way of transporting it to population centers. Like and that's just one blessing. So when you go into that understanding, well, God promised insane blessings to the descendants of Jacob, and then you understand, like, it just really brings those blessings to life, brings the Bible to life, showcases the power of God. Like, he really delivered on those promises in a spectacular way.
Absolutely. I love talking about geography. I think we're going to have another article about geography and in the next issue or soon. And it is, I mean, you're right. It is kind of insane. Like the thing, one thing that really caught my eye, I might have mentioned it before, but one time I looked up why is it called Mar-a-Lago, that estate that President Trump owns. And it means ocean and waterway, or ocean and lake, I think. Oh, ocean and lake, or sea and lake. And I realized that that's when I found out about the Great Loop. So there is a contiguous a continuous you basically you can get on a like a three-man boat, like a little boat, and you can go from basically kind of the front door of Mar-a-Lago along the oceanic coast, because we have barrier islands that just happen to calm the waters before they hit the coast. And you can go all the way up through, I think it's like Michigan, and then back down the Mississippi, and then end up at the back door of Mar-a-Lago. Like that's how connected. They call it the Great Loop, and a lot of people have done it. I mean, not the front door, back door Mar-a-Lago thing. That's kind of my little way of explaining it, but these are highways. It's really important to understand that you can transport things four times easier, sometimes way easier, on the water than you can on the land. It's like, well, I'll just make a road, but the road's already there, and no one is account c can account for that, except for God made it. You know, here's this piece of land that is largely uninhabited, that just happens to be safe from all the drawbacks that Europeans have living right next to each other with limited resources. Here's this huge real estate with you know, mineral wealth and these rivers that we're talking about, the way that it's arranged, the kind of cold desert to the north and hot desert to the south that limits neighboring powers from getting too powerful. This is not, you know, I would be embarrassed to brag about America, because it's just so clear that we have been given advantages that no one else has ever had just by the geography. You know, an article just about the geography and the climate, you know, could be kind of added to that, is explicitly God level, right? This is whoever formed the dry land, and the plants and the layers of rock and minerals and things that are part of the dry land. Whoever has that type of power, that scale of ability, made North America and just happened to also give us, you know, the right people at the right time and all the rest of it. So to brag about America is to kind of confess some ignorance. If you don't immediately bring in, we Americans are just custodians of embarrassingly unusual blessings in the history of the world, and we're responsible for doing something with this, and we do feel guilty and should feel guilty if we are not doing whatever it is we're supposed to be doing with an enormous, multifaceted, myriad blessing of just this land, just the dry land and the waters and the territory that Lincoln mentioned. De Tocqueville, he starts off his Democracy in America just talking about the extraordinary disposition of the North American continent, which is, I think, a good place to start and a good place to kind of start this issue.
Mr. Ron Fraser used to talk about the multifaceted mind of God. I just like that kind of statement or that phraseology. And there's so much, I think, about this aspect of American history that can just set your imagination on fire. Like just the timing, the number of different factors that had to work together. I really like Stephen Ambrose's book, Undaunted Courage. I don't know if you've read that, about the Lewis and Clark expedition, but he has a great kind of introduction, just setting things up. And one of the points that he makes there is that kind of around 1800 and around the time of the Lewis and Clark expedition, like the idea of a continent-sized country was just kind of unthinkable. Like nobody had traveled faster in the long run than a donkey. Instantaneous communication was not possible. Like the idea that you could keep together an entire continent-sized country under one government, like people just didn't think that was possible. When it's going to take you days or even weeks for news to travel from one side of the country to the other. And so you have then this continent-sized geography being given to America at the same time as the technology is developed that allows you to feasibly run that, and the telegraph kind of being invented in tandem with America's expansion and the railway. And I think there's so many exciting, fascinating facets of this history and how everything just ties together. I mean, you can talk about the same thing with British history. You know, the way that Britain, like, we don't have quite the same superabundance of raw materials that America has. It's a much smaller geography. But the raw materials Britain does have in abundance are coal and iron. What are the key raw materials for the Industrial Revolution that kind of catapults Britain to greatness? Well, it's coal and iron. And then you've got the geographic advantages of being an island, and for the United States, from being kind of a continent. I mean, you've got Canada and Mexico, but even there are major important geographical barriers, making it very hard for these nations to rival the United States themselves and to invade or threaten the United States. So you've got that going on. You've got then the way this kind of intersects with some of the political side of things, like, well, you need a certain security from invasion to really have freedom. You know, if you need a big army to keep yourself safe, it's very easy for a ruler to use that army and to become a tyrant. So can you have that kind of freedom without the geographic separation? I think, I can't remember whether this is something that Jeremiah gets into or one of the Stratfor articles that he kind of used in researching this, where I think George Friedman kind of asks the question, is an American-style political system even possible in Russia, where you have to work so hard and you need so much close coordination to get the food from where it's grown to where the people are, where it's not as just as simple as sticking it on a boat and sending it down the river. Now, I think there's other considerations in there, national character, other parts of historic heritage. But like so many of these things kind of all come together, the development of technology, the march of history, geography, to have Britain and America just explode onto the world scene precisely when they did. 1776 for America's independence, the Louisiana Purchase coming along, just over 25 years after that, Britain, the Industrial Revolution in Britain, this specific time. And another book I really like is Paul Johnson's Offshore Islanders about British history. And he's not a Marxist historian, but has this kind of sense of the direction of history. And you almost get the sense of somebody with their foot on the brake at times and the accelerator. And he talks about everything, kind of all of these, a whole variety of elements coming together in exactly the right mix at exactly the right time around 1800 for the Industrial Revolution to take off. And I think this brings us to Mr. McDonald's article, See God in American History, where he explains how the Bible prophesied, yes, the rise of Britain and America, but also the exact timing when it would happen. And when you read history with that in mind, with that understanding, and it's fairly simple to prove from just one biblical chapter, Leviticus chapter 26, it really shows God ruling in the affairs of men, his power to step in and shape history according to his will. I mean, this is what makes history exciting. And so I love that article as well is included in this issue.
Absolutely. I mean, how can you can't skip the Louisiana Purchase. And like you said, I mean, we could write a book on the Louisiana Purchase, you know, just on the what happened in, you know, the late 18th century or early 19th century, and how, you know, everything kind of converged to make that possible. This mentions that, and then it just kind of blows the top off by telling you this is directly, like, countably, you can like calculate back to Bible times. What's the quip? It's like, if you think 1776 was spectacular, you need to know about American antiquity. It's like, you know, America doesn't have an antiquity. We're 250 years old. What are you talking about? But this will connect you straight back from that miraculous event where we just peaceably got it on sale. Got the center of the North America for, I think it was 3 cents an acre. And, you know, most kids, I think, still learn about that in elementary school. You know, they can tell you how much Louisiana Purchase was per acre. But as exciting as that is to understand, this is talking about Babylon and Persia and Greece and going back before that time and Abraham. So either it's not true, you know, or wow, world history is just stunning. And then you look at all of world history, and then there's like this exclamation point when Britain became powerful, and then we benefited from we were British and we benefited from all of that. And then you guys didn't, no offense, but you didn't treat us British enough. So we said, all right, we got to be our own country then. It wasn't that we wanted to be less British. We actually want to be more British, but it didn't work out. But even that's accounted for in the Bible, a nation and a company of nations. So like you said, it's pretty plain and it's not that hard to comprehend what's being claimed here in this article is being claimed in the United States and written in prophecy. But it explains a lot. It explains, I really appreciate that analogy of the foot on the brake and the foot on the gas accelerator kind of metaphor, because that's what you're looking at here. And how many people, how many, at least in America, we have some viewers of this program. Wait, I think we are in the, like, how many of us are living in the Louisiana Purchase? We're literally drinking the water from from our wells, looking at trees that were there, growing when the, like, we are living in these prophecies. And churches are embarrassingly ignorant if they're not teaching this, and they're not. But it's explained, it's revealed there in the United States and Britain in prophecy, and in Genesis. So July 4th, 2026, you can just count back 250 years to our founding.
Well, I think that brings us to one of my articles, The Forgotten Keys to National Success, which also talks about the Lewis and Clark expedition in a slightly different context. And I mean, this is starting to get into some of the other side of the coin that there's a debate, fascinating debate that was held years ago between Niall Ferguson and George Friedman on what makes a nation great. And George Friedman argued geography. And Niall Ferguson argued institutions. And really, I think you do kind of need both. I mean, like we were talking about with Mr. Flurry's article, both of these get back to God. Blessings from God, the geographical blessings, and the institutions, ultimately, the government of God, the law of God. I mean, that's how you're going to have the most successful country possible. And the closer you get to God's law, God's government, the more successful you're going to be. And so this article starts to get more into, say, the Niall Ferguson, the institutions, the law side of the equation. And one of my favorite genres, say, of historical books to read is I like reading about voyages of discovery. I'm not saying they're the most profitable necessarily, though I think there definitely is profit in them, but I find it absolutely fascinating. And it's just really interesting to, I was just reading some very different books. I mentioned Stephen Ambrose's book, Undaunted Courage, about the Lewis and Clark expedition. I was reading some books about Captain Cook and some of his voyages around Australia and the Polynesian Islands. Reading about Henry Morton Stanley and David Livingstone exploring Africa. And one of the things that just really hits you reading these very different books is the commonalities that they're discovering in these peoples that have nothing in common. Like these massive sins, really, that they have no idea are sins, they're sincerely deceived on, that is there in Indian tribes that Lewis and Clark are kind of meeting for the very first time, that have never really encountered, certainly Americans before, in North America, that in these Polynesian islands that have never encountered Europeans before, and these African tribes that have never encountered any white men before. And a lot of the one of these things is they almost have no concept of theft. Now, that's an oversimplification. But their attitude towards private property is radically different. And then when it comes to family morality, again, it is radically different. Like the idea of marriage, one man, one woman. I'm not saying that Western civilization has been perfect on this, But the idea that this is an ideal to be aspired to just isn't there in many cases. And there are like a lot of, they're way off. You know, it's not, say, polygamy where you have one man and four women. It's to the point that in several of these different cultures, it's like the wife's brother is the one that is the man in the child's life. Like it's just all similar, weird and wonderful ideas. I mean, not really wonderful, but very different from biblical morality. And I think what I find fascinating as well is this is now celebrated today. I mean, this was celebrated by Engels. Engels talked about this, Friedrich Engels, the kind of great compadre of Karl Marx. And he is promoting this as, well, this is what we should be emulating. We should be going back to these societies. This is what modern universities are kind of saying. Property rights, the patriarchy, this is all everything that is wrong with America. But you look back at these societies and what else do they have in common? They're all spectacularly poor. They all have, I mean, it's not politically correct to say, but culturally, there's very little in the way of achievements. Scientific and technologically, very little in the way of any kind of achievements here. I mean, people will try and kind of say, well, all cultures are equal. There are no Beethovens and Bachs from these civilizations. There are no Newtons. There are no Einsteins. Like, there is something badly wrong. And not just with measuring it, say, materially on monetary success and how rich are you. Okay, I get that may not be a perfect measure of cultural success. But even on these kind of levels of, say, even spiritual enrichment, cultural enrichment, it's not there. The success is lacking. And I think part of this points to the fact that how vital the truths that Britain, America, and even other countries and cultures have gotten from the Bible, how vitally important those are. But I also think it's exciting too, because you look at, well, these civilizations that are really low on this scale of biblical truth have horrible outputs. Britain and America, even at the heyday, you know, you would say they're probably only fulfilling a small percentage of God's commands and what's in the Bible, but they were vastly more successful. So then once you have a civilization that is striving to fully implement what's in the Bible, I mean, that's going to blow out of the water even the greatest level of prosperity and culture and science and arts that you've had from Britain and America. And I think it gives you a glimpse as well of just what is possible. The cultural success, the economic success, just the human flourishing from God's law.
Right. I mean, you were just really thrown down the gauntlet there, haven't you? I mean, to mention those things that we're not supposed to acknowledge. One of the things that one of the World Cup, I don't know if he's really connected to the World Cup, but one of the things I've been seeing kind of in association with that on the internet is a couple of South African men who are just blown away by a gas station in Alabama or whatever, where there's nothing locked up. There's literally merchandise on shelves outside of the store because it's more convenient. And then the person's supposed to go inside and pay for it. You know, he's just blowing his mind. And he comes from a nation that had that, like had that. Zimbabwe had that thanks to the British Empire. And so they got handed that and they ran it into the ground with the same physical resources that you're talking about, but the different institutions based on different understanding of what's right, what's law, you know, whether Marx and Engels are to be followed versus Abraham and Moses. So that the institutions is absolutely the determining factor, because you could be at Sinai in the desert and have a functioning society based on these laws without many physical resources. But I say that you've thrown down the gauntlet because the nations, the British Empire and its Commonwealth, the United States, are better nations than these with the ones that you've mentioned in terms of power, wealth, culture, human flourishing. Okay. That is a fact. But we have a problem. How do you explain that? If you do not believe in the United States and Britain and prophecy, then you have a problem. You're not racist. I hate people of other races, but you've got a problem because you cannot explain how vastly superior institutions, virtues, laws, ways of government, institutions, came to exist. They came to exist within our ancestors, and either we are the undeserving recipients of the choicest bounties of heaven in terms of institutions as well, and have done a miserable job with everything we've been given, and yet, still, just by virtue of how merciful God is and how much He has given and how much He keeps His promises, we have become great, in these ways that I've said. Either that's true, or somehow we came up with it. Somehow our races came up with it, in the mists of the lodges and buildings of, England long ago, and we don't know how it happened, but it happened, and somehow, our peoples developed these institutions and these things. So you got a problem. You've got to explain. You got to admit that these nations are great, self-evident. Now you have to explain it. And that's what's missing so much of this America 250. All of this, almost all of this America 250 celebration is completely missing that. And that is a problem. That's not a side issue. That's not like a issue for religious people to debate. But there is a God in Israel. There is a God in the United States. This is where all this came from. We have not served him well. We need to try to do better. Big understatement. Well, we just kind of came up with it. We don't really know how, and we're just going to consume all the wealth and glory that we can, and kind of be that caricature that you're talking about, of flag waving Americans who are totally ignorant of what they possess, what they're living in. So these forgotten keys to national success that you're talking about, I think in the next article as well, talking about these institutions, everything that's actually good about Britain and America came from God, and you can trace it. It's not just like this general thing. You can trace what those institutions are, what those laws are, as you did in this article.
And that does bring us nicely to the next article. Is the US Constitution based on the Bible? Which, that's kind of the hidden assumption behind a lot of this discussion. Did these values in the Constitution come from the Bible? And this article goes through and shows, again, that there's a lot of pretty deep truths that have their origin in the Bible, that America's founding fathers accepted, that a lot of civilizations and a lot of societies did not accept. And those truths come from the Bible.
This is an interesting one. We tried to write this years ago. I helped managing editor Joel Hilliker with it, and I just I had recently read some. We'd all recently read some wonderful Hillsdale College books about the Western heritage and the constitutional, the Constitution. The Federalist Papers, selections of the Federalist Papers, and. I didn't understand it well enough, and I think we didn't understand it well enough because it just got shelved because it's a challenge. You're saying that in the Bible, it talks about a pretty, top-down government. There's not a legislature. There's not, you don't vote. So how is it that the Constitution is based on the Bible? And this article gets there. Like it we can acknowledge that it's not, we didn't just, take scriptures, like you said, and say, okay, this is the law of the land. Interestingly, colonial charters back when we were British colonies literally cited chapter and verse. There was like, you shall do this. This is the civil law. And then it had like Second Chronicles or Deuteronomy or whatever the relevant verse was. So that's the environment in which this was written. It was a time when people were literally citing chapter and verse as the law of the land when people were trying to establish the rule of God on earth civilly, but then even, you know, and like you said, unlike other nations, we look to Old Testament biblical examples of the judge, like how judges were to judge, how you know, the government in a sense was to be limited. I mean, God is unlimited, but the human beings that he entrusted, you know, he had a priesthood, he had a judge, you know, those were separate. Even the king, you know, of a nation of Israel would have to obey the existing laws. You know, the rule of law was over the top of the king, and also couldn't, you know, do certain things that were reserved for the priest. This article just gets into that. It talks about the Mayflower Compact, connects that. I mean, it says, you know, one paragraph talks about Sinai, and the next paragraph is talking about the Mayflower Compact. It's talking about these underlying assumptions, understanding what human beings are and how they should be ruled, how people should have equal justice, how basically we're all under God, which the Declaration of Independence mentions God four times. And he's not directly ruling us, like, it doesn't say this, but, you know, he's not directly ruling us in the way that he was at Sinai. And I don't think they knew that we were the descendants of those who were at Sinai. Physically, they thought we were, you know, I don't know, culturally, religiously descendants of those at Sinai. And because of that, no man has the right to rule you in the way that they did in the old world. That's not biblical. And so this constitution isn't, I mean, it isn't the way that Moses ruled Israel, and it isn't the way that God will rule when you know, he actually rules the earth. But it acknowledges the fact of, as the sidebar says there, the Anglo-Saxon heritage goes back to the Bible. It goes back to Sinai, and people have the right and responsibility to have equal justice under the law, and then to pursue what it means to be a human being, what it means to be an American, not as a functionary of the state, not as an ant in the hive, but as, you know, it leaves the spiritual things to the spiritual, and it tries to limit the civil government from trampling the garden of the church.
Well, the next is again one I wrote that ties in, I think, quite directly to the way we set up the episode: why the world should celebrate. And I kind of pitched this article in the meeting, not necessarily intending to be the one that wrote it, and also not having dug into it all that much. But naturally, you know, my mind is kind of more on non-Americans. And we're talking about this issue, doing the special 250th anniversary issue. We're doing it at a time when, you know, it was last week, there was a big survey out in Germany, for example, showing that the nation is dramatically less friendly towards America, or dramatically less likely to view America as an ally. And, you know, I don't want to get into, well, who's responsible for that? Is that Germany? Is that Donald Trump? Or all of that? We'll save that for another day. But this is the context that we're writing this. And just in some of the, say, the little I knew before writing this episode, it's like, well, there is a lot for the rest of the world to be grateful for the United States, that has been lost in a lot of this acrimony and animosity. And that's what I dug into in this article. And I think, you know, it doesn't overstate it to say that there are hundreds of millions of people during the 20th century that lived to a ripe old age that would have died without the United States. Like, hundreds of millions. That is not a light contribution to human history. And it's a contribution, though, that is almost entirely overlooked. I mean, America basically single-handedly pioneered the idea of food aid and stepping in and saving people from starvation. I mean, this is how America has used, like, we talked about those insane blessings. This is how they've been used. And that is, I think greatly to America's credit in many ways, and something that the world should acknowledge more. Then when it comes to some of these values that we've talked about, the values in the Constitution, in spreading those values, that has, and then those values bringing success, that has done a huge amount for the world. I mean, this statistic, I had to try and fact check a few times because it sounds unbelievable. But between the end of the Cold War in 1990 and today, so this time where America has been the number one hegemon, the undisputed superpower, where there's been no rivals, it's had a freedom to act that even during the Cold War it didn't have, and an ability to spread some of its values. Well, 100,000 people per day have exited extreme poverty. I mean, that is a positive contribution to mankind. 1950, about 60% of the world lived in extreme poverty. Today, it's less than 10%. And okay, it is an oversimplification to say 100% of that is due to the United States. But I think there's a whole lot of other countries that if they had been the sole superpower, you would have a very, very different outcome. And that's just a couple of statistics. And then you start to get into America's contributions in world wars, the victory in World War II, that, okay, it's an allied victory. There are other countries involved in that, but America was an indispensable part of that victory. And what a gift that is for the world, the defeat of Nazism that would have plunged the world into a new dark age, the winning of the Cold War. The entire reason the Soviet Union did not invade Western Europe is because of the United States. And the United States putting its survival on the line. Hey, if you go into West Berlin, we'll nuke you. And that's going to perhaps mean that you nuke the United States back. But, we're going to make that promise. And, your move, Soviet Union, do you call our bluff or not? And then just the use of the U.S. military, like, the U.S. military as a first global first responder, and the power that's there is kind of simply astounding. Like the way that America's military presence around the world has been used so that if you experience a natural disaster, very soon, often within 24 hours, a U.S. nuclear aircraft carrier strike group shows up there and they're like, we have a portable nuclear power station. We can churn out thousands, we can desalinate and create tons, thousands of tons of fresh water. We have tons of food supplies. We have helicopters and hospital ships and platforms to land them off. We have sophisticated electronic means of finding people. Let's help. And that happens time and time again. This is a these are all pretty impressive contributions to the world made by the United States of America that I think even coming as a non-American, we don't talk about enough and you don't hear about enough.
I was about to say it's all the more powerful coming from an Englishman, writing the article. I mean, the examples that you were giving, I wasn't aware of. You started with, or you mentioned one in the meeting about the, people being in the path of a volcano and the Army Corps of Engineers helping in that case, just many examples of this type of thing. And again, think of it not as a American thing. You can, they didn't do that for just altruistic reasons. I think Manassites, Americans, are just kind of naturally generous. We have so much more to give than so many other people. So it's not extraordinary, or it's not that we're virtuous in that way. But it's a human thing, like. So let's pretend like it's Mars and there's civilizations on Mars and you don't know any of them. And there's like civilization A and B and C and D. And one of them does what the British Empire did. One of them does what the Mongolian Empire did, the second biggest empire ever exists. One of them is like the Russia, and one of them is like, the United States. Like if you're just whoever you are, if you just care about people not dying, people having clean water, whether it's after a disaster or like their whole lives long, I think that's how I hope people look at this issue. because it also exposes that there's something wrong with the way we think, in that we have a special non-logical hatred for what the British Empire did in the world and what the United States did in the world. It's not logical. Now it's absolutely true that British people who say that that came from Britain are wrong, and they shouldn't do that, and that's actually very destructive. It's wrong for Americans to say, well, this just somehow came, I don't know how, but it just kind of came out of the American character. The American people are just this way, and that's how we got to be so powerful and so wealthy and have good institutions and do these things for other nations. That's wrong and bad. And if other countries resent that kind of pride, I mean, you just wrap that all up in the word pride, they're absolutely right. But if you just kind of can step back and look at this as a humanity thing, good came to the world. And we've got to explain that.
Yeah, there's some great thoughts. And it does point out this rising spirit of anti-Americanism, anti-Britishism. Like, I think it does expose the irrational nature of some of that. And I'm not saying that either nation is perfect. But why is this left out of the discussion? I mean, the British Empire's great legacy of to the world, and one of them is wiping out slavery. Or certainly the Atlantic and then the Arabic slave trade. Like, I think it's a contribution almost unmatched in human history, and in a world obsessed with slavery, somehow that doesn't get talked about. And there is something fundamentally irrational behind this. The attack, like, that America is portrayed as, you know, this kind of selfish warmonger, and all of the good is left out of the equation. Like, what is going on there? And that is where that is part of the broad, that, you know, there is an evil spirit. There is a spirit world. There is Satan the devil. And that is a big part of his broadcast right now. You know, there's always a general broadcast of a kind of a patriotism that exalt, that hates, that loves my own country and hates other people's, and that puts down other people's countries to put up my own. And there's a danger of that patriotism in the United States on the 250th anniversary celebration. And there's a danger of that reaction around the world, looking at that and kind of maybe being irked. And, you know, I was kind of joking a bit about insufferable flag waving at the start. You know, there is a danger there. And then you, like, just trying to then to nitpick and put down. And that's always an element of human nature, a part of human, you know, factionalism and rivalries, as it talks about in Galatians chapter 5. Specifically now, though, you know, Jeremiah 1 talks about a boiling pot towards the north, like a cauldron of seething resentment that is building in Europe. Psalm 83 talks about an alliance that says, well, we want to blot out the name of Israel entirely from history. Like, we don't, not just blotting it off the map, we don't want it in remembrance anymore. That it just hates these nations that are descended from Israel. That is what is building right now. And I think when you look at the good that Britain have done and America have done for the world, and the way the world is reacting, you see that spirit. And maybe that's something more to get into another time. You mentioned the infographic, which is a great summary of some of those points that were made in Jeremiah Jacques' article. And it really does. We should have mentioned it when we were going over that, because it really does make a lot of these incredible geographic blessings of the United States really pop. But another really important article in this issue is this America's Golden Age? Because this is another message that is certainly being broadcast by the White House and some within the United States. You know, Donald Trump has talked about, well, this is it. This is the 250th anniversary of America, and we're going to have another wonderful 250 years. Your State of the Union address, our nation is back, bigger, better, richer, and stronger than ever before. A short time ago, we were a dead country. Now we are the hottest country anywhere in the world. And there have been some big changes in the United States, but that's a big push of this 250th anniversary. We're not just, it's a, not just a celebration of American history, but a celebration of how great America currently is right now, a celebration of America's power, for some, a celebration of America's righteousness. You know, there's been a lot of religious activity around this 250th anniversary, And there is a way that that can be done right. I mean, we've just talked a lot about how that history points to God. But if that is there's a danger, and some of these events, the message is more, hey, America is righteous. You know, we are powerful now because we are righteous. And so, you know, this article, is this America's golden age? President Trump says yes. What does God say? You know, there's a warning that we have, there's a response we have to have to that side of America's 250th.
Absolutely. And this might be, in a way, I don't know, but this might be the most important article in this issue. I don't know, kind of speaking off the cuff there, but this identifies so much of the problem. Like, and some people rightly resent this in Americans because it is wrong. It's dangerously wrong, because we have this tendency right now, well, we've always had this tendency to blend in whatever we're doing right now is good. Like we're finally celebrating this country. We've been told to be ashamed of it for so long, and now we're just celebrating it. And whatever it is that we're doing, and we might like kind of do almost the opposite thing next week, and we'll celebrate that if a certain president is the one doing it, or whatever. We're just kind of blending whatever it is we want to do, and saying that it's good, rather than saying there's an external definition of what good is, and we've got to conform to that, as our presidents before, including Abraham Lincoln, have told us that God defines right. God doesn't change. God has given laws. We have broken those laws. Both sides of the main controversy, both major parties, have sinned against God, and we must repent. We must literally stop eating and feel the pangs of hunger to remind ourselves that we're just pitiful human beings, and go to church and plead with God to show us, to forgive us. That's what he was said in his, you know, fast proclamations. And this article talks about, I mean, look at, marijuana is everywhere. Prostitution is like a do-it-yourself kind of thing at this point. How many American daughters are doing that? You know, he talks about gambling, but then he talks about, there's a subhead here, it says things God hates. Perhaps you are not among the 70 to 80% of Americans who have either used marijuana, gambled, or viewed pornography in the past year. But there are still many more sins that are even more common. And this is where I think I have to take note, the viewer has to take note, because sin and the bad things are always things that other people are doing. Other nations are doing bad things, and other Americans are doing bad things, and other Republicans are doing bad things, and other patriots are doing bad things, and other Christians are doing bad things, but not me. You know, we all this deception that our conception of right and wrong is right. But pride, like literally, like we are saying we are proud, with no mention of God, no mention of God. That's just, you're not even mentioning God when you're talking about how great America is. You know, the excesses. You know, some people rightly point out that, you know, a lot of things that people are, Europeans are dumbfounded by are the excesses, the excessive size of the cereal boxes. And, you know, like there's excesses of in this country. There's lying. I mean, we have kind of broadened the tent, you know, the conservative tent. Not that I'm a political conservative, you know, but that the conservatives have broadened the tent to be like, well, you're into, you know, this, you sing this in your rap lyrics, that's okay. You like Trump because he's a winner. We're all winners. And you're just kind of incorporating all these sins. They're sins. They're the sin is things that destroy. And God tells us what they are. And we're, you know, Americans are just kind of absorbing those and celebrating those. And then, like somebody mentioned in the meeting yesterday, putting God's stamp on it and saying, and God is, and God bless America. You know, we have girls dressing like this, and we're doing this this fighting event right here on the White House lawn, and we're smoking and drinking and singing songs about, you know, whatever it is, and celebrating the use of our military, which, you know, the military is in charge of killing people, so we should be pretty sober about that. Not that we shouldn't ever use it in this world of Satan, but we should be pretty sober and not treat that lightly. So there are many sins that this article talks about being that are straight from the Bible. Was it 2 Timothy? Self-love, covetous. Are Americans guilty of covetousness? Is that causing a problem? Yes, it is. Covetous, unthankful, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, truce breakers, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. He just goes right down the list. And even mentions, you know, UFC 250 in here, the fight, was it yesterday, maybe, at the White House. And just blending it all in with the bald eagle imagery and the waving the flag and bombs going off. And I've seen a lot of supercuts or montages of America, 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 this year, and have enjoyed a lot of it. But I see in all of it, you know, the same thing we're talking about, that this is, if we are not going to turn from sin, as even our own presidents have told us in the past, and just sort of absorb it and call it good, then we will fall, and much more tragically, we deserve to, because God gave us the good that's in this country. God gave us the institutions, the laws that made us, even as we just very imperfectly kept them or accepted them, that gave us everything we have, and we're turning the world away from those laws. We're showing the world, look at all this that we have. Don't you want it? And then pointing them in the direction of that harms them, you know, that doesn't give them aid, that what are we going to, you know, what do you know, are Indonesians or Japanese you know, Kenyan, you know, they look at this country and they look at the wealth and whatever, and the things that they might want, and the iconography that we celebrate, and then they see all this sin blended right in there, and they associate those two things when the whole purpose that we have, the geography that we have, the institutions that we have, the blessings that we have, the right thing at the right time in history that goes back 4,000 years, and we're using all of that benefit to turn people away from God, to break God's laws, and to act like you can do it with impunity. It would be unrighteous. It would be bad for the world if Nation D does that, or Civilization D does that, then the world needs that nation to be punished, to show that that's not right. That's going to lead you into misery for millions of people. We have to be punished. We have to be, or it's not fair to the world. We'll lead the whole world in the same kind of, you know, self-destruction that we're kind of indulging in and celebrating. So the main point just being, sin is the enemy. God is the real source of the good, not Americans or British or our ancestors or anything. God is the real source of the good. Sin is the enemy. And if God is whatever civilization, A, B, C, D, whatever, like wherever he is in those civilizations, that is what is good. And wherever sin is, even if it's in my civilization, in my party, in my movement, in myself, in my family, that is sin. That is bad. That is destructive. And that is the enemy. Like you said, Satan's real. The influence of sin is real. And this article, you know, is perhaps the most important one to read for people who might be engaged in those more obvious sins that have we've kind of rationalized and accepted, or the less con the boasters, proud, blasphemers, unthankful, that we've also rationalized and feel like, oh, the people who smoke marijuana or the people who are on this, you know, OnlyFans platform are bad, but I'm good. All I do is a little bit of lying here and there. So we all have to be corrected by God, and this article kind of lays that out in kind of a current news, you know, current events type of way, and I think it needs to hit home.
And one of the things I appreciated about this article is, you know, there's a extreme sins are becoming common, you know, like for a whole generation of, well, like drug taking, you know, that used to be more of a, I mean, it was still common for certain segments of society, but it's kind of a mainstream middle class thing now. Consuming pornography, common. Making pornography, now common. But one of the disastrous effects of all of this is that it makes things like lying. You know, some of these other sins, it's like, well, at least I'm not doing that. And they can seem less bad by comparison. And so this is a, rightly so, a corrective article talking about the things God hates, you know, a lying tongue, a proud look, you know, an exposure of what is going on in the United States and why this isn't a golden age and why the apparent greatness that we do see around us is going to come crashing down very, very soon without massive, massive changes. Well, the next article, Manifest Destiny. This is your article. This is, I think, perhaps the most unique of all the Trumpet articles. You know, maybe something more like would appear in the New Criterion or oh, what's it? I can't remember its name now. The Lighthouse. Or so there's a few more literary magazines that I'll read sometimes. Than say The Spectator or The New York Times. So I mean, perhaps you could talk us through this article, What America Was Born to Become.
Yeah, this was a challenge because the idea behind it is to describe what America will be like in a real golden age. We're talking about how the golden age that the current president is the salesman in chief is promoting, mixes just like slices of things that are truly good with just a lot of things that are not. But what are we saying? Like, what do we want? What should America do? What would a real golden age be like? And you know, what were the founders trying to reach for? What was Abraham Lincoln trying to turn us away from, you know, turn us to? You know, which even they would say, well, we don't know, but we just hope that, you know, our children and their children and their children will get closer to what human beings were created to become. And this John Adams has an explicit quote about that, you know, trying to reach for what human beings are meant to become. And reach for what this nation is meant to become. So it was a challenge to write it, but I just in this article I just tried to, well, drop a whole bunch of references to the 7 days of creation and some American poetry, Democracy in America as well. So there's kind of like some inferences or some implied references there to some of those things. But I just tried to take us back to creation and to what a nation that recognizes the obvious truth that only those nations only are blessed whose God is the Lord, that recognizes the salubrity of climate came from somewhere, that the navigable waterways of North America came from somewhere, and keeps a day a week to, as specified in the holy book of our ancestors, to recognize that creator and to worship that creator. I think it starts with that. What would a society that's built on that be like? And it tries to get back to God could have done things different ways, but he chose a specific nation, right? He could have worked through many different people and many different nations. The point is that God works through nations. And so I'm just trying to describe, as best as I can conceive of it, taking the best, the things that you just love about this America 250. I just love it. Like I said, I've seen so many supercuts and montages of, look at this giant ship with all this cargo coming in these harbors and these, passenger jets and these cities and these skyscrapers and these hometowns and these main streets and block parties and these people on a boat waving a flag. Just this feel good sense that is here in America right now. And like I wrote, take a look at some of these well-produced America 250 festivities and just use your imagination. And I'm trying to say, imagine that you don't have to ignore the fact that those girls go home and sell their bodies for money, like on video, that there's not a some drug paraphernalia among the cooler of drinks and other stuff that those people are, have, that there's not this ugly underbelly, this rotten core that sin has inflicted upon us and we have indulged in. Imagine that that's not there, and imagine that in its place is people keeping the Sabbath, keeping thou shalt not steal, honoring their father and mother, remembering the Sabbath day, telling the truth, the opposite of the last article, loving others more than themselves, having natural affection, not accusing, not loving pleasure more than God. It is, I mean, it's possible. God does command it, so it's possible to at least, do the things that he's commanded us to do. It we you know that it's not possible to fully repent and be born into the family of God, but just as far as national repentance and a good physical life and the birthright promise being enjoyed and fulfilled, and importantly spread to other nations, not just consumed by ourselves, but spread to other nations. This is just trying to kind of paint a picture of what that would look like. And just to give some hope, to give some hope that really, actually, in spite of us, our blessings are in spite of us, our future is really in spite of us, Americans. God will correct us as we need to be corrected, and he will make this and more than this a reality in the children of Abraham, who the Americans are and the British are and others. So I don't know. It's a different kind of thing, and it's just meant to kind of put you in a frame of mind for a few minutes of people recognizing the God of all creation, or however Abraham Lincoln said it, and to realize that there is hope for the future, but it lies in keeping that law. It lies in getting to the source of the good, which is the creator, not of just America, the creator of mankind. So I call it God of Israel nationalism. There's so much nationalism over here. It's like, stealth bomber nationalism, cowboy nationalism, you know, baseball nationalism. What we really need is God of Israel nationalism.
God of Israel nationalism. Interesting summary of the whole issue, and a positive one. I think that points us to Mr. Flurry's commentary, which can be, a positive story to end the show on. America will be great again. I mean, that's an important point to make alongside of the Americans' golden era. I mean, in some ways, the message of America's golden era is America is not great right now. I mean, I guess if you're measuring it by global share of GDP or global share of military power, then yeah, America is great. But if you're looking at morals and obedience to God's law, that is not so. But as this commentary says, if you believe the prophecies of the Bible, you will understand why no politician can make America great again. Only God can do that. I mean, if God made America great in the first place, that's the logical conclusion. And Mr. Flurry continues, it must be done his way. But he has given us ironclad promises that he absolutely will do so. And these promises are of a greatness on a whole different scale, on a whole nother level, compared to anything America or any other country has experienced so far. And God is not a respecter of persons. You know, God makes promises of similar greatness to any country that is going to obey him. And you've got these passages in the Bible where God promises greatnesses to Assyria, in modern day Germany, and to Egypt, and you know, to these countries that have historically been rivals to Israel. His promises of greatness, promises of harmony between these two. And this article concludes with some of those promises of greatness for America and for Britain, and what God intends and will make sure that they do with those promises of greatness.
Right. And he specifies, he says, anciently, the nation of Judah went into captivity. That is what it took to awaken the Jews. So the nation fell. The nation was violently conquered and destroyed. After 70 years, they returned to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple. They were they were teachable and trembled at God's word, and they were ready to obey and build for God. This has actually happened in history in a small way, in a city level. That is what it takes. That's what it's going to take for America. It needs to happen. If we will not repent, it absolutely needs to happen for the sake of human beings. In all nations, in all generations, they need to see that when you sin like we sin, you experience the consequences of that. That needs to happen if we will not repent. We can repent. We can be teachable and tremble at God's word now. But if we won't, then Mr. Fuller says, this coming captivity on the nations of Israel, Britain, America, Israel, Jewish nation, this coming captivity will have the same effect on a much larger scale. We need to be humble. We need to be obedient. We need to say, teach us your laws and we will obey them. That has to happen for the sake of not America or Britain alone, but for humanity. Because interestingly, after all of this, God, like you said, he blesses Egypt and Assyria, and he loves them equal to Israel. Yet he still chooses Israel, even after the return of Jesus, after all this destruction that we're about to experience, and the actual return of Jesus Christ to literally rule literal physical national governments worldwide. After all that, he takes this beaten, defeated people of Israel who have no wealth and no power and also no reason to be proud, because it's just been shown to our faces how evil we've gotten, how prideful we've gotten, and how godless we've become. And so he will take the Israel and he will make it the lead nation, and he will work through it and kind of filter the blessings through them, and we will have at that point no reason. We'll have no reason to be prideful. There will be no, I don't think there will be any mistaking. Well, is it because they're just a better people, or they're smarter, or they're more evil, and so they got advantages? Or it's like I think at that point, the average American, the average Manassite will say, I think it's pretty clear at this point that we did not generate these blessings. We do not deserve these blessings and never have. There is a God in Israel, and all nations will come to that God.
Well, I think that's a great point to conclude on. Thank you very much for joining us today, Philip.
Thanks. I wish I had a little American flag right now. I could wave. I've got some, but I don't have any with me. It's been good to be with you, though.
Well, in honor of the World Cup, I'm going to go off and play some football now. But thank you very much as well to Victor Granados for engineering and production. We have been talking about our latest Trumpet print magazine. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. If you scroll down on the right, and Philip's holding up the cover right there of the latest one, you can go, you can read it, you can download the PDF, you can subscribe, so you receive a print copy of each issue as it comes out for free through the post, pretty much wherever you live in the world. We're very happy to send that out to you. So you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. We'll be back on Friday with our regular Week in Review show, where we show you how all of the events of the last week fit right in with God's plan for mankind. If you have any questions, any comments, you can get in touch with us at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. And until Friday, well, keep watching your world.